Welcome to another conversation around social impact. Today, I'm talking with Sarah Spiziali. We'll be exploring the diverse range of work that she does, focusing on education and mental wellness, looking at the groups that she works with, and also exploring how she created this work, which is both personal to her and also works within organizations. So without any further ado, I'd like to welcome Sarah. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Robert. Thank you so much for hosting this interview. It's great to be here.
You're more than welcome. So, Sarah, it'd be great if you could give us a little bit of an introduction around yourself as a coach within this sort of field that you sort of specialize in, and just give us a sort of a brief journey of how you got to that point.
Okay, so I qualified with Animas three years ago. I started my journey, and I was before then a qualified therapist, an art therapist in the specific. So that was the first viewing point of coaching. I was training as a therapist, and I heard about coaching, and I was like, oh, that sounds really interesting. And then my therapist suggested I didn't start a coaching training whilst I was doing a therapy training. So I was like, okay, I think that's good advice. So I worked as a therapist for a few years, and then was still very much intrigued by coaching. And I've been practicing as a coach and a therapist for I would say 2-4 years now. So I bring a blended approach to the work I do with clients. So yeah, my background is in education. So I worked very much in the educational space to begin with, moving into mental health, working with Mind as a therapist, as a mental health advisor in schools, and then as a coach in my current position with a tech startup, working mainly in corporate. So it's been quite a journey.
So as I understand it, you've had this idea of social impact and social sort of inclusion and work within what you've done throughout your journey. So why don't we start at the beginning to sort of look at how that work showed itself sort of within education?
Sure. So I always had a passion working with people of all ages, trying to bring out or support them in bringing out their passion, their talents, their potential. And that was something I was born into. So my family business and background was very much in education and drama and education. So it was, how can we learn through games, fun, theatre, creativity, and that was my bread and butter, I would say, throughout my upbringing, and that led me quite naturally into education, so working with teachers and students and finding innovative ways of doing, you know, lessons that could be language lessons, mainly that was specifically to English, teaching English in Italy, but it could be spread out throughout the curriculum. So I started creating teacher training projects, and I started doing that in Iceland and Finland because that's where I studied at bachelor and master's level as an exchange student. So I absolutely fell in love with what I saw in those classrooms, and I thought, okay, there's definitely a need for this in Italy. And so I started creating like small exchange programs for teachers, headmasters, and university professors. And that way they could see what I'd seen, they could exchange best practices with their colleagues in different parts of Europe. The northern part of Europe is well known to be quite excellent at education, especially Finland. So it was a very impactful project that I felt I just started with an idea, and then I'm very happy to see that it's still running. So I now delegated that project to other people, but there's quite a good number of teachers above the 1,000. I'm not sure if we're close to 2,000 yet, but definitely a good amount of teachers that then impact other teachers in their schools and students to just be more student-centered and person-centered and just bring out what they want to bring and not just be like passive in a scholastic system that is very rigid and doesn't allow much space for the individual.
So as I listen to that, I can hear how that project would have a huge impact in the classroom with the young people, where their teachers and head teachers had been on this exchange, and you kind of casually threw away this idea that you set this up and organized it. It'd be great to hear a little bit more about sort of what goes into setting up an exchange project that has such an impact.
So it starts with wanting to do it, I think, like really having the desire to share something that has deeply touched and moved and transformed you. And then I think through that drive and that passion, you kind of become contagious and connect to people that want to do or believe in the similar idea. So I started with the connections that I had. So as an exchange student, you would probably always have a contact internal to the university, and that's usually a good way to start. So I started contacting the administration office and the headmasters of the schools that I had gone as a trainee as part of my university course. And very much from there it built, because then from connection, other connection was created. So maybe one headmaster would put me in touch with the Department of Education of the town, or maybe someone would put me in touch with the university, another department, or another school. So I'd never visit, say, kindergarten. So by the end, by spreading this web of, I guess, connections that didn't necessarily start with me, but people that had known someone that I'd met directly, we were able to visit the whole scholastic system. So from kindergarten all the way to teacher training programs at the university. And we were able to go into Iceland, this is. So in Reykjavik, we were able to speak with the mayor's office and get the perspective of the city town hall on education. And, you know, old professors of mine or friends would then join in the more social side of things. So we would run Italian dinners, which is something Italians are famous for, obviously, around the world. So we would bring food from all over Italy. So we would go with groups of 50 teachers. So you can imagine that's a lot of food. So we would invite friends and all the teachers and professors that were hosting us to these dinners. So we would create also a moment of cultural exchange. That was very, very nice and enriching for all parties.
So I see there that sort of double impact of both an educational shift and exploration, but also a cultural exchange there that sort of really enriches how somebody might take part in such a program. So it's not just about what are we learning. There is a wider understanding of the people involved in the program.
Yeah, absolutely. We really wanted to feel like we were inviting everyone to, you know, our hometowns, and that happened to be like maybe not 50 different hometowns, but close. So we would get a sense of us sharing our culture. So there would always be, for example, singing and music, sometimes dancing, and they would have also the opportunity and the joy of sharing their culture with us, especially if you go to remote places, or what used to be a remote place, not so much maybe now, but Iceland, you would really feel the locals being overjoyed by sharing their culture and traditions.
And I'm wondering here, what were the challenges around setting up such a project? So I'm really hearing this idea of making connections that enable connections to happen, and it feels like it really flowed into its being. Were there any things that sort of happened along the way that really sort of challenging for you to deal with?
Yes, I think at the beginning I was quite ambitious in wanting to set up host families for all the teachers. So that was feasible with a small group, but I didn't see that being a reasonable amount of effort for a larger group. So that was one challenge in how far do I spread this project and what are the boundaries that I want to put in place for this project to be the best use of, you know, everyone's energy and time and resources. So there was a bit of exploring that, like trying different modules of the project program. And then there was a challenge in deciding how big do we want to make the group, because it was a quite successful project as from the beginning. And there was a nice feel to having a smaller group. And I was quite protective of that at the beginning. But then we realized, well, there's actually so many more people that want to participate. So moving from a group of 20, 25 to double the amount, that was obviously logistically making sure that everyone got, you know, fed, got in time from A to B, or the transport and the language, you know, translating things. Do we want to translate constantly? No. So put that on the program. If you want to come, you need to be confident in your English, because we don't have time to, you know, always translate things that have been said. So things like that. And definitely challenging dealing with some of the participants. Definitely. I think that was the biggest challenge. So managing that role of group leader and having colleagues helping you out while maintaining your patience, I think that was quite challenging.
That's really great to sort of hear how the project evolved and developed as you sort of worked through that. And when you sort of look back on it now, are there things that you sort of think, oh, I wish I did that differently, or I wish we approached that in a different way?
Overall, I'm quite happy with how it went. So there's no regrets, let's say, per se, but I think there's always the desire of wanting to have done more, in the sense that I started recently my last project in Estonia. So I've just organized that remotely, so I've not physically been there. So that's, for example, something that I would like to be able to do. That COVID hit, so we're still waiting for that to happen. But I guess there's always a sense of more people could know about this. We could do more more trips during the year. So for me, it's always a question of balancing that desire to do more while always being able to offer something of excellent quality and consistency with the resources that we have, that I have as well.
I think there's something really key there around when somebody's setting up a project and that desire to impact a lot of people, how we might need to begin small and work our way up to reach those numbers so that we can sort of work out all the nuts and bolts as we move forward on the project.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always a challenge. I don't think I'll ever put it to rest, because there's always this wanting to do more, better, share things that obviously have a positive impact, you know, more and more. But then I think for me, the learning was also, how do I make sure that I maintain a good self-care routine throughout this? Because what happened is I did find myself quite exhausted at times. And then that's obviously putting you in a position where you can't offer anything to anyone. So that's not the ideal position to put yourself in. So I think balancing that desire and that drive with actually reminding yourself that you need energy to spare to be able to do these things is not something that came naturally to me. I had to learn that. It's sometimes the hard way as well.
So if we sort of move forward from those education projects, what was the sort of the next landing point for you?
So the next landing point for me was definitely moving towards more mental health. So as you can probably get from my story, it's not that I ever was a classroom teacher. So I always had this passion for seeing people come alive and open their minds to new, you know, things, challenging themselves, overcoming challenges, finding that they were stronger than what they thought they were. And I think when I did this project for students, I think that's what really came alive, seeing this, this potential so alive and awake and alert in them, and seeing transformation happen in front of your eyes, was really what really got me to say, okay, you need to learn more about this. What is it that gets you so so excited? And it was more the mental element and the more in-depth work that was going on internally. So that moved me towards actually qualifying as a therapist, and I wanted to become a creative therapist. So I moved to London to do an MA in drama and movement therapy. And that, funnily enough, led me back to school, but as a therapist. And I did that work for as long as I was based in London, and I loved it, and I loved being back in an educational setting, but with this different hat on. So I was working in schools in Hackney, specifically secondary schools. So that's an age group I really love working with. And I was working also at my university. So I was invited to come back once qualified to be a mentor for university students that were facing challenges with their mental health. So I worked sometimes with clients for 3 years in a row throughout their whole BA, and making sure that they knew that they could access skills and tools and believe in themselves and build that confidence in them and that resilience so that they could get to graduation. And I was really happy to see them graduate at the end.
So I hear there how you're, you know, working with individuals, but you're also working with schools, and I understand that you also work with larger organizations that have that desire to explore mental well-being, not only in education, but also in the workplace.
Yes, exactly. So the last kind of stepping stone in the educational field for me that led me into more the organizational world was working for Mind, the mental health charity. So I was a mental health advisor there. So I was bringing in coaching and therapy, and it was beautiful to be able to do that. In other jobs, I have a very clear boundary between, is this therapy, is this coaching, or is this mentoring? So that was another very useful challenge and learning curve for me, balancing all these different hats and skill set. And working with Mind gave me access to schools at an organizational level. So we were working on this project called the Mental Health, the whole school approach to mental health. And I was giving presentations for the whole school at times, and that was bringing awareness around mental health challenges from, you know, the youngest student to the most senior position in that school. And through that, I was approached by my current boss, Laura Stembridge, who is the founder of Inside Out. So I'm now completely surprisingly landed in the tech startup world, which I never, ever thought I would inhabit. I never thought it was a space that would find me in, and I would find a place and such an amazing learning opportunity. And I'm now working more in the corporate sector. So we, as a startup, enter the usually the workplace. Sometimes we work with individuals, but we work from small startups to SMEs all the way to multinational a company such as Deloitte. So that's very much an extremely exciting place to be as a coach, as well as a therapist. And I'm the head coach and therapist in the startup. So it's been also a joy to play around again with that connecting exercise that I was mentioning earlier and say, okay, who do I know in the coaching space? Who do I know in the therapy space? And there's quite a few Animus coaches that work with me at Inside Out. And it's a growing space. So it's a space where whatever idea we have as a team, we have the opportunity to explore and maybe to create in a very short time.
So I remember having conversations with you when in the sort of the earlier days of Inside Out, as you were sort of pulling the idea together to bring it to the organization. So it would be great to hear a little bit about sort of what was that journey of having this idea of working with mental health within organizations, and how did you enable that to happen, to sort of materialize, as it were, into the space?
So it was, again, I think a very strong part of believing that this was needed, believing that this was going to bring a positive impact in people's lives. And I think it was driven by my personal experience with mental health challenges and the CEO's personal experience with mental health challenges. So I think that comes across when you meet people, companies, clients. And we started with offering training sessions. So entering the space and offering mental health awareness training, small groups of employees would join. We would immediately encourage open, honest conversations around mental health, leading by example, so sharing our stories with mental health challenges, and making sure we had an understanding of what we meant by mental health. And my work in mind, or at mind, was very much a foundation for then moving into this new space and training groups on fighting stigma in the workplace, creating a better culture around mental health. How can we create support networks within our organization? And so that was the foot in the door, if you will, with new realities that had never heard about Inside Out. I'm sure it was quite a fertile time, generally speaking, because the media is talking more and more about mental health. It's becoming more and more important to have it on the agenda. And then we started recruiting. So the idea from the beginning was, how can we get everyone to access therapy 24/7, wherever they are, in the comfort of their own home, cutting, you know, transport, commuting times and costs. And we started with literally my network. So the first people we hired were people from Animus, people that I'd met through training as a therapist. And then from there, we started expanding and reaching out to other professionals. And the next step after that was creating content. So creating tools and creating self-help programs that people could access. So it was diversifying the product. That was the journey.
And when you sort of look at that journey, I'm wondering, were there any things along the way where that made you think, oh, maybe we should stop this, maybe this is just too much hard work? And if there were, how did you overcome that?
Definitely a lot of hard work. Definitely a sense of, oh my God, is this really happening? And then it's like, oh my God, it's happening, now what? So that sense of like, okay, this was an idea. Yes, we believe in it. Oh, wait, other people believe in it. Oh, okay, great. Like, and I think that's the world of startups. I've never been in that world before, so maybe this is normal to many other people. But for me, it was, quite surprising how quickly things could happen and change. And I think the main challenge actually is that, like, being always on your feet and thinking outside of the box and being extremely flexible, because things can change so quickly, and in the good, like for the good and for the bad sometimes. And also having that responsibility, I felt, of being the head of this team of 40 plus therapists and coaches to date, and creating that sense of community, even though we're over, you know, remote, creating that ethos and representing that ethos of the company. So coming up with the mission statement, the value system, and then actually taking that off from the paper into reality and saying, okay, how do we actually translate this? How do we communicate this to everyone else? Because we were then visible. We had a website, we had a team. And so I think that was the biggest challenge, I think, seeing an idea really become reality in front of you and through you. I think that was quite extraordinary.
And as you talk about that, I sort of wonder around how you were able to fund this particular project. We don't necessarily need the details of the sort of the funding streams, but it kind of sounds like the educational projects were sort of self-generating, self-funding. But this feels like a much larger project where you're talking about websites and bringing in different coaches and therapists to work with you and supporting them having a mission statement. And as people listen to this, they'll be sort of thinking, okay, but how do I begin that? How do I get the funds to make something like this happen? And what sort of thoughts might you share with them around that?
Yeah, so definitely I think having the right CEO is key, because I know I'm in the right place within the organization, so I'm taking care of what I know how to do best. The CEO was definitely the one in charge and charging forth when it came to fundraising, and I could see that her biggest strength was coming from her authentic story. So having come out of mental health challenges herself, that really made her connect to people. And I think people were drawn to her because there was that level of authenticity in her mission to make sure that people didn't have to suffer what she had to suffer being part of the corporate world, because that was her background. And I think obviously there's a big work to be made behind the scenes when it comes to fundraising. So I know we have people that fund the startup. I'm not personally involved in this part of the business, but I know she, you know, is very much active in joining events, speaking to events, creating a huge wider and wider network. The startup is investing in, for example, hiring people now, or actually as we speak, looking for a senior executive salesperson. So I think she also drew from her network to begin with, definitely. So some of the funders came from her network. And then it's that, for example, another big part of that is bidding for opportunities. So definitely one thing that I think is very important to mention is we were able to join a huge accelerator program. So I think that really made the idea come alive and threw it into another league. So I think being part of this accelerator program, which was with Founders Factory, which is based in London, in South Kensington, really put us to test. So it was like, okay, so now we have this huge team actually working for us and making us get to that next level. So we had a lot of pressure to meet targets, to make sure we were delivering on time what we were promising, and also gave us a huge opportunity to learn so much from other startups, because that's the environment that we were in. So there were many, many startups around us all trying to, you know, to get to that level where you could have the best, you know, website that you could think of. You did have the team in place. You did have the coaches and the therapists ready to deliver the product, and you have the support to do it. So I think definitely if you can get those kinds of opportunities and get those kind of partnerships, really, really makes a difference.
You talk a lot about connections and community, and I just wonder if you'd like to sort of share any thoughts that you have around, you know, how you build those connections or how you build those communities to support the multiple sort of projects that you've been involved in.
Yeah, I think that's a natural inclination of mine. People do call me a catalyst sometimes, so I think it's a natural talent of bringing people together, of managing to connect with people that might not connect so easily in other circumstances. So I think there's an element of a natural predisposition, but I think there's also a belief of the power of connection that really makes me make the effort, maybe that extra effort to build that sense of network, because I see the potential of it. And then once there is, say, a community that I are either part of, or in this case that I feel I've somewhat had a key role in creating, then there's a sense of responsibility that kicks in, I think, and wanting to make sure that we feel part of something together, and that we can share this amazing set of skill set that we all have that are very different and unique to each and everyone. So I think also this this inclination of wanting to learn and make the most of opportunities and situations is something that's quite typical of me, but also I think that is then mirrored in people, you know, wanting to do the same or wanting to encourage others to tap into that pool of knowledge and potential and skill set, and actually realize that we're stronger together, that we can pool all our enthusiasm or experiences into, in this case, a virtual space, and amazing things can come out of it. So I think making sure that people do feel part of something is what always drives me in creating that sense of community and shared knowledge and best practice, especially because coaching is such a somewhat new profession compared to many others. I think we have an amazing opportunity here to really set the standard and build that sense of professional expertise and excellence. And it's great to feel that you're part of it and that you can invite, you know, people that you know, and then ask them to invite other people and be part of a global movement.
When you look back at the work you've done, I'm just wondering, what is it that you can sort of point to as a moment that you're most proud of?
I think I felt quite proud when I realized that my role was taking care of a group of coaches and therapists, most of them probably more senior than me in some ways, and that this was possible because I believed in an idea. I believed in the possibility of a conversation from a complete stranger to become something. And then when I saw it actually becoming a real, you know, job, paying, you know, more people than me and the CEO, and having clients that have positive impact from it, and companies, you know, signing pledges to really put mental health in the forefront of their, you know, innovation. And it's just, yeah, it's quite exciting. And I feel very, very proud to be part of it. Yeah.
So I feel like you're somebody who is moving from one project to the next. So what's on the horizons for you?
Well, that's a good question. I always dwell. What next? And also, how much is enough? So I think the challenge now is to embrace what I have, and really be present 100% in what I do and not rush into anything else, but just allow things to emerge in a natural way. So this kind of organic approach to whatever next. I don't want to force it. I am in a new space. Like, I live in a different country. There are communities here that are quite exciting, that kind of make me think, okay, maybe I could do new things or go in this direction or that direction. But I think there's another side to me that's also thinking, okay, but you have quite a lot on your plate as it is. So maybe just take a moment and just, yeah, pause, and then maybe things will emerge rather than chasing or driving more and more projects. Because I think if I've learned something from past experiences, is you can get really tired, and there can be a trap in, okay, when is it enough, you know, like when can you say, okay, this is good, I'm content, and then if things happen, okay, great, moving forward. But actually being present to what you have is maybe where I'm at right now.
That's really lovely. I think there's something really important to be mindful about, you know, the work that we're doing and the importance of it, and not necessarily reaching for the next thing, but allowing something to emerge. And you spoke a little bit about that, you know, sustaining self. And I'm wondering, if are there any tips that you might be able to give people about how they might sustain themselves when creating new projects?
Yes, definitely. I think, yeah, that's so important to really talk about. Well, my self-care kind of routine is trying to be as much in nature as possible. That works really, really well for me. Trying not to be too static, so keeping an active routine. So be it work, walking. There's a Freudian slip. Work was coming out. So being walking, dancing. I love dancing. It can be, you know, gentle exercise according, or running according to what I feel. So always trying to be also in the self-care, not trying to push anything, but just trying to listen to what you need in the moment. Creative outlets for me work really well. So it could be something simple as coloring in or doodling, or it could be painting, listening to music. I have therapy, so that's another thing that I always recommend. As a therapist myself, I had to go and have therapy to become a therapist, but I always like having therapy regardless of having to have it or not, because I always find it a very good and safe and nourishing space to have as a self-care space. And yeah, the most important thing for me is have enough sleep. If I don't sleep, I can't function, and I'm not nice to be around at all. So I think, yeah, simple things actually, I tend to forget at times, and then it's kind of a snowball effect.
So it's really interesting to hear how the sort of self-care work that you do for yourself is also supporting your own mental health, and then the projects that you're doing support other people's mental health, and how this is all sort of strung together through that connection and the communities that you are involved in or that you create, that then allow that work to emerge and to be followed up.
Yeah, I love how you neatly tied that up. Yeah.
Definitely. So it's been wonderful speaking with you, Sarah, and exploring this journey that you've been on, exploring how you've worked with others and the impact that's made. And I wish you all success with your new projects, as well as your new being with what is right now.
Thank you so much, Robert. It's been a true pleasure speaking to you.